inc.com. Patchy fog late tonight, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52, and tomorrow, widespread fog early, then becoming mostly sunny. We do have a chance of rain in the evening. Highs tomorrow, 71 to 74.
Allies expressed solidarity with Poland and denounced Russia's reckless behavior.
Russian drones entered Polish airspace overnight. In response, Poland invoked NATO's Article 4. What does that mean?
For Wednesday, September 10th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead, we'll bring you the latest on what we know about the shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk.
Also, millions of U.S. voters have now been run through a citizenship data system. How's it working so far?
We just want to make sure, where's that data going? And at the end of the day, is it stored? What are they going to do with it?
Also, a new book tells a true story of spies, counterfeiters, and the short life of the playwright Christopher Marlowe.
Human beings can't actually be shut in the tight boxes of censorship. And Marlowe is the supreme example of the rule breaker.
Those stories after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Turning Point USA says Charlie Kirk is dead. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the 31-year-old conservative activist, a close Trump ally, was a driving force in the MAGA movement. He was shot dead while speaking at a college campus in Utah.
In a post on Truth Social, Trump says, quote, "The great and even legendary Charlie Kirk is dead." Trump adds, "He was loved and admired by all, especially me." The president also offers his sympathies to Kirk's wife and the couple's two young children. At 31 years old, Kirk was a popular right-wing influencer who helped galvanize young voters in support of Trump. Kirk was speaking at Utah Valley University when he was shot in the neck. It was to be the first on a 15-stop college tour for his organization, Turning Point USA. Republicans and Democrats alike have taken to social media to condemn the shooting, saying political violence has no place. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
The Trump administration's federalization of policing in the nation's capital expires today. But as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports, the Washington, D.C. National Guard has extended its deployment, assisting law enforcement in the district.
The D.C. Guard's encampment has been extended through at least November 30th, which should guarantee the troops will qualify for uninterrupted benefits and pay, according to National Guard rules. In a Facebook video, Brigadier General Leland Blanchard notes that they're spending time away from their families and their normal day jobs.
Thank you to all of our soldiers and airmen. Thank you to the families. Thank you to our employers. Without you, we couldn't do this.
It's not clear if the other eight states that have sent almost 1,400 additional guard will also extend. The White House says crime is down, but the D.C. mayor's office says violent crime had already been falling for months. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
NASA scientists say it's one step closer to learning whether Mars once hosted forms of life. NPR's Bill Chappell reports.
NASA researchers say they found potential signatures of life in a rock sample from an ancient river valley on Mars. Nikki Fox is an associate administrator of NASA's Science Mission Directorate.
This finding by our incredible Perseverance rover is the closest we've actually come to discovering ancient life on Mars.
The rock sample has patterns of what researchers call leopard spots, made of minerals. Fox says that on Earth, such patterns are often linked to biological processes.
It's kind of the equivalent of seeing leftover fossils, you know, leftovers from a meal, and maybe that meal's been excreted by a microbe, and that's what we're seeing in this sample.
NASA wants to bring the samples back to Earth for more analysis, but right now, there's no plan or money to do that. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
It was a mixed day on Wall Street. The Dow declined 220 points. The NASDAQ added 6. The S&P had a gain of 19. This is NPR News. Nearly 1 in 5 children younger than the age of 13 say they're spending up to 4 hours every day on social media. NPR's Richard Chatterley reports that's according to a new study by the digital security company Aura.
Researchers at Aura looked at data of phone use among 8 to 17-year-olds who have the company's software on their phones. Prolonged use of social media by those 13 and under suggests kids either override age verification or use social media excessively with parental consent. They also found that many kids start their mornings by checking their phones repeatedly. Psychologist Scott Collins, chief medical officer of Aura, says use of AI chatbots is common among teens.
The average message length is 10 or 12 times longer than the message length that they're just sending a text message to their parent or their friend or even on Snapchat.
He says more than 36% of these conversations involve sexually explicit or romantic scenarios. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Three college basketball players from Fresno State University and San Jose State have been permanently banned by the NCAA, this for betting on their own games. The NCAA says two of the players did not cooperate with investigators, but one did. The three reportedly shared thousands of dollars in payoffs from the scheme. The players manipulated their performances during the games to impact the outcomes during the 2024-2025 season. The bets at the time were flagged by a Nevada sportsbook operator. All three are no longer at the schools, and the university in these cases were not punished. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
You are listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 5:06. Support comes from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pekegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Walker Ethnic Fest is happening this Saturday with food and art from 10 to 5, a parade at 11, and live music from noon to 9, all in downtown Walker.
From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Conservative activist and Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk has died. President Trump announced his death after Kirk was shot at a college campus in Utah. The president has ordered flags to fly at half-staff to mark Kirk's death. Kirk helped usher in an age of in-your-face conservative politics, especially for young voters. NPR's Stephen Fowler joins us now. Hi.
Hey there.
So, Stephen, having the president order flags to half-staff, that's something traditionally done in times of mourning. Tell us, what kind of relationship did Kirk have with President Trump?
Yeah, so flags are at half-staff. Think instances like the death of former President Jimmy Carter and other national tragedies. And this is because Charlie Kirk was somebody who was close to President Trump and was a trusted voice for the administration, particularly speaking for and about young people. Trump, announcing Kirk's death on social media, said, quote, "No one understood or had the heart of the youth in the United States of America better than Charlie."
Let's take a step back here if we can. What can you tell us about Kirk's appearance at today's event there in Utah?
He was speaking at Utah Valley University. It was the first stop of 15 planned American Comeback Tour events at college campuses around the country. Kirk was well known as an energizing speaker and organizer focused on young conservatives, getting them registered to vote, getting them involved in their local Republican politics, and really activating a key demographic for a party that has struggled at times with young people. He was one of the most influential voices in the GOP, with a popular podcast and video show that regularly influenced policy discussions and how they were talked about both inside and outside of Washington.
For people who may be less familiar, tell us what it is that made Kirk so influential.
He cut his teeth pretty young, Juana, as somebody as a skilled debater. He had often provocative framings and held events like the one at this college campus where he engaged with opponents and ideological critics instead of one-sided diatribes. His Turning Point group got started as a college campus free speech organization, but as Kirk got older, he became more savvy, turning debating and rhetoric into action. He was only 31, but in the last few years, he expanded Turning Point USA's empire into working with faith leaders and playing a large role in the successful ground game in the last election, helping turn out voters for Trump in key states. And that's really how he cemented his place as a heavyweight in mainstream Republican politics.
Stephen, this is still a developing story, obviously, but there's already a conversation going on about political violence and that escalation. What can you tell us on that front?
Well, we don't know much right now about any motivation or anything about the shooter. We do know there is a deep concern from Americans about politically motivated violence. A July 2025 poll found 3/4 of Americans see politically motivated violence as a major problem. Just a few months ago, somebody assassinated the Democratic Speaker of the Minnesota State House. There was arson of the Pennsylvania's governor's mansion in April. President Trump was shot last year on the campaign trail. But in the aftermath of this killing, Juana, you do have figures from across the political spectrum denouncing political violence and expressing condolences to Kirk's family.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, shifting our focus overseas now. You may be familiar with NATO's Article 5. It is the cornerstone of the alliance, a provision in the treaty committing NATO members to protect each other. It has been invoked just once in the history of the alliance after the 9/11 terror attacks. Well, today, Poland invoked NATO's Article 4, this after more than a dozen Russian drones crossed into Poland overnight. NATO scrambled fighter jets to shoot them down. That marks the first time NATO planes have engaged enemy targets in NATO airspace. So what is Article 4 and how might invoking it inform what comes next? We're going to put that to Rose Gademüller, former Deputy Secretary General of NATO. Rose Gademüller, welcome.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
What does it mean to invoke?
Yes, Article 4.
Article 4, yeah.
Article 4, yes. It's very clear. It states, and I quote, "The parties will consult together whenever, in the opinion of any of them, the territorial integrity, political independence, or security of any of the parties is threatened."
They will consult.
So this is the step before. Yes, this is the step before any invocation of Article 5. And I must stress that they are separate. This is just to consult together and to discuss the situation and exactly what happened and try to come to some conclusion. It is not necessarily by any means a prelude to invocation of Article 5.
Is it right to see it almost as an intermediate step that might or might not lead to invoking Article 5 and collective defense?
Traditionally, it has been a way for the allies, when they have run into a concerning security situation, to be able to gather together quickly. The message is one of urgency, and the message is one of the allies, with due regard to the potential for escalation, taking very careful stock, talking among themselves, and deciding exactly what the situation was and what action, if any, is required. So I don't want to in any way indicate, again, that this is a prelude to Article 5. It is very much the allies showing that they can quickly come together to act if they must, but they're going to be very careful in figuring out what is required.
How quickly? Like, how quickly would you expect a meeting to happen?
Well, it's happened today, so that could happen very, very quickly. And it's important from that perspective that NATO does have a regular presence at the headquarters of all its member states. And so everyone can be gathered together very quickly to meet and to consult in this way. Mm. So, but I think, you know, almost more important was the quick military response, which you reported on a moment ago, and the fact that all NATO countries were maybe not involved directly, but certainly aware of what was going on. And then we had countries across the alliance. There were the Polish F-16s involved, but also Dutch F-35s, Italian AWACS planes, refueling aircraft. So it was really a large-scale NATO operation, again, conveying that the NATO allies can come together quickly in order to respond to an urgent military threat.
Rose Gademüller, you spoke a moment ago about the way this has traditionally worked, which prompts me to note there is precedent. I was reading that since NATO's creation, Article 4 has been invoked 7 times, most recently, I gather, in 2022. That was by members in Eastern Europe following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. For this current, today's invocation of Article 4 by Poland, what kind of message is it intended to send? I mean, NATO could just say, hey, we're going to meet, let's everybody get on the phone or gather in Brussels without invoking Article 4.
Yeah, no, Article 4, because it is part of the Washington Treaty, the founding treaty of NATO, really conveys a seriousness of concern, first and foremost, and a seriousness of consideration of what the response should be. And so I think that that is the core message here, and that mm-hmm. is what Article 4 is all about. NATO allies meet multiple times a week at NATO headquarters in Brussels, but getting together under the aegis of Article 4 conveys a grave concern and also a readiness to really develop whatever response measures are needed on an intensive
right.
and quick basis.
We've got about a minute left, but I want to flip the question around and ask, what kind of message is Russia sending? Why is Russia sending drones into NATO airspace now?
Yes, it's very interesting when you read the official response of the Russian Ministry of Defense. They said kind of coyly, the destruction of targets in Poland was not planned. So there could be two reasons why these drones strayed into Polish airspace overnight. Mm-hmm. The first could be that it was a genuine mistake, and the Belarusians have said that electronic warfare was jamming these drones, and they strayed into the Polish airspace, and Belarus even warned Poland about that. So that's a possible explanation. Okay. Another one is that Moscow indeed was probing and probing air defenses and seeing how the Allies would respond. So that's, I think, the decision that NATO's weighing now. What exactly was this? Was this intentional, or was it an accident?
Rose Gademüller, former Deputy Secretary General of NATO, thank you.
You're welcome.
Scientists have long used sound to better understand nature. NPR's Nate Rott reports on a new tool to help them find sounds in one of nature's more noisy environments, rivers.
Say you're in your backyard or out for a walk and you hear a bird.
Usually you can see it.
Katie Turlington is a PhD candidate at the Australian Rivers Institute at Griffith University.
Or even if you can't, you can whip your phone out and take a recording, upload it online and ID it.
Terrestrial animal sounds are all around us. They're familiar.
But we obviously don't have that underwater, right? We don't hang out with our heads underwater. So all of these sounds are very foreign to us.
And that's especially true for rivers, where Turlington says even if you did put your head underwater or dropped in a waterproof microphone, with all of the water flowing, there's so much background noise that it's hard to pick out anything else. Which is where Turlington's new tool, a computer program, comes in.
So this tool, it detects that background level. And then anything over that background level, it pulls out.
And groups together with similar sound. So instead of this cacophony, you get this. The isolated sounds of river bugs. Or fish grunts. Wait, fish grunt?
Very bizarre.
Is it just like working hard, just trying to stay in the current or something?
Yeah.
Huh.
To be clear, Turlington says only a small percentage of fish make sound, but this new tool can find those sounds within hours instead of the days it would take to manually go through a 24-hour recording and listen. Turlington says she hopes it can help scientists get a baseline of a river's sound.
And then once we know what normal is, if we hear any changes, we can go, ah, something's happening. So maybe we lose a species sound and we go, oh, let's go and check, something's happened.
Or they hear a new one and can go see if it's an invasive species. Either way, she hopes her new acoustic model will help sound become a management tool for people monitoring river health and to help all of us terrestrial beings better understand what's happening under the water. Nate Rott, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. You're listening to People Powered, KAXE, and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, Ari Shapiro talks to author Steven Greenblatt about Dark Renaissance, which explores the life of Christopher Marlowe, the playwright he describes as Shakespeare's greatest rival. At 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. And at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Coming up at 7, Sara is your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smartwool. PattersonsClothing.com. We also thank the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. Patchy fog late tonight, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52. Widespread fog early tomorrow morning, then becoming mostly sunny. We do have a chance of rain tomorrow evening. Highs tomorrow, 71 to 74, and our evening lows near 60. For Friday, slight chance of showers in the morning, then partly sunny, temperatures in the upper 70s. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food. Offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Greenwood Cemetery in Bemidji is looking for volunteers to help with recovery efforts after this summer's derecho. Anyone with availability and equipment is welcome to join the effort before winter comes. You can call us or text us if you need more information, 218-326-1234.
NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The new book, Dark Renaissance, is a true story of spies, counterfeiters, betrayal, and murder. It's about the short life of the playwright Christopher Marlowe, Shakespeare's greatest rival. And the world of this book has some uncanny parallels with the present day. The author is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Stephen Greenblatt. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you, Ari.
You've been obsessed with Marlowe for decades. You tried to convince the people who wrote the movie Shakespeare in Love to make a film about Marlowe instead of about Shakespeare. Why does he fascinate you so much?
He had a strange, disturbing, powerful life, and he was a great creator. He actually paved the way for Shakespeare and for much that we actually care about in the culture of our language and our civilization. But he was a strange person and lost, a lost soul, died at the age of 29. So it's a fugitive life, a life hard to get one's hands on, but full of mystery, but also full of excitement.
The mysteries make this book so thrilling, but before we get to those, what do you mean when you say he paved the way not only for Shakespeare, but for so much of what we value in our culture today?
Christopher Marlowe was born into a world that was heavily censored in terms of anything anyone could dare to say, let alone to write. If you mumbled unpleasant words about the ruler, or about the policies of the state, you could get your ears cut off, you could get your nose sliced, or very likely you could get yourself killed. That kept people's heads down, as you can imagine.
And then comes along Marlowe, who, as you write, said out loud what no one who wanted to live a long life would even venture to whisper.
Absolutely. Marlowe took crazy risks. We don't fully understand those levels of risk now because we can say, basically, in our society, what we want about the people, at least for the moment, the people who are running our country. But that was not the case in Marlowe's world. And Marlowe, about the religious settlement in his country and about the political settlement, said things that you wouldn't say if you wanted to live a long, happy life.
Why? How? How did he get away with it? When the rule was don't speak out, how did he flourish and become such a huge success by violating that cardinal rule?
It's a good question, Ari. The first thing to say is he didn't flourish for very long.
Yeah.
He went to spend the day with, evidently, with some people he knew when he was 29 years old, and he ended up dead. But before then, he broke through by exploiting, in an absolutely brilliant way, the first great public entertainment industry in English culture, which was the theater. And in the theater, as opposed to outside, you could actually say, as Shakespeare followed Marlowe and understood, you could begin to say things that couldn't be said elsewhere. And Marlowe broke through with a play about a poor-born peasant, Tamburlaine, who conquered the whole world, who brought kings to their knees. And he excited thousands of people, ordinary people, who went to the theater in the 1580s and saw this spectacle of a nobody who conquers the world.
Or there's a play like Dr. Faustus, which before Marlowe took it on, was a pretty straightforward morality tale of what not to do. And then Marlowe's version comes along, and it looks enticing and sexy and almost homoerotic with all kinds of themes and nuances that were unheard of in this story that had existed for a very long time before his play.
You're absolutely right, Ari. He took a rather cheesy account of a German magician, and he turned it into a fable that has remained actually central in a way to us of what it means to make a deal with the devil in order to escape the little box that you were in. Marlowe ends the play by having Faustus, as in a good morality tale, dragged down to the devil, to hell. But before that, he has the character, Dr. Faustus, explore the world inside, the world outside, and as you've suggested, also the sexual world. This is a play, insofar we don't remember, most of us won't have any idea about this play, except we might remember, was this the face that launched 1,000 ships and burned the topless towers?
Of course.
About Helen of Troy. This is the kind of thing that Christopher Marlowe did, and as I say, transformed popular culture, English culture, our culture.
I went into reading this book thinking, how can there be anything new to say about somebody who lived in the 1500s? And your research blew my mind. For example, you make the case that he was a spy, recruited while studying for his master's degree, by looking at cafeteria records from 1584 to figure out when Marlowe was on campus and how much he was spending. Explain that for us.
Well, first I should quickly say, Ari, that people have pored over those records now for several decades. They're extremely hard to read. But yeah, the university kept track of the students' consumption of beer and food, and you can follow actually whether he was there at Cambridge when he was supposed to be. And in fact, that issue came up when he tried to get his degree, because the university authorities said he wasn't there for long stretches of time, and they refused to give him his degree. And then a month later, a letter was sent, signed by the most important people in the kingdom, on behalf of a nobody, the son of a shoemaker from Canterbury, saying, Her Majesty would be unhappy that someone who's done the state such important service should not be given his degree. Give him his degree. And guess what? They gave him his degree. And there's other evidence for this as well, that he had been recruited, as after all, there's a tradition of going to universities and recruiting people for the CIA or for MI6 in England for the spy service. And that's evidently what happened with Marlowe in a time in which these are in the years leading up to the Spanish Armada, in which spying was a very both dangerous and highly important game.
I said that there are some uncanny parallels between Marlowe's time and ours. What do you think we can learn about the moment we live in now by studying the time that he lived in?
Well, we might learn that even when a culture looks like it's shut down, and we look around in our world at places in which there's ferocious repression for the freedom of expression, there will come along someone who will break through. Someone brilliant enough, daring enough, crazy enough to speak out. Human beings can't actually, for long periods of time, be shut in the tight boxes of censorship. And Marlowe is a supreme example of the rule breaker in every way, politically, religiously, sexually, who breaks through the enclosures that authoritarian regimes build around free expression.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Stephen Greenblatt, his latest book is Dark Renaissance, The Dangerous Times and Fatal Genius of Shakespeare's Greatest Rival. It's about the life of Christopher Marlowe. Professor Greenblatt, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. Information about this summer's Martini Monday music series available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Patchy fog overnight, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52. Widespread fog early tomorrow, then mostly sunny, high 71 to 74.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Authorities have identified the 35-year-old woman who died in a three-vehicle crash on Friday in Virginia. Virginia police say the victim was Tara M. Schumacher of Eveleth. Eyewitnesses told police that Schumacher swerved into oncoming traffic and struck two different vehicles. She was unconscious and not breathing when responders pulled her from the vehicle. The two other drivers suffered non-life-threatening injuries. Police say they believed Schumacher was under the influence of an intoxicating substance at the time of the crash. It remains under investigation. Two big questions are looming without definitive answers from Governor Tim Walz: whether he will officially call a special session to address gun control measures, and whether he'll seek a third term as the state's top leader. In two separate stories, the Minnesota Reformer reports the likely answer appears to be yes in both cases. Two people who were in a group of 100 or so Democratic donors on Tuesday told the Reformer that Walz made it clear to them he intends to run again. Walz has also told several people privately but definitively that he will run again, and he will make a campaign announcement next week, according to the Reformer's sources. A Walz spokesman declined to comment. A DFL source who was at the event said Walz was thrown off by the June killing of Representative Melissa Hortman, who was a friend and governing partner. But the recent mass shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis, quote, lit a fire in him. The possible special session also comes in the wake of the shooting. After meeting with legislative leaders behind closed doors on Tuesday, Walz told reporters he would, quote, call a special session one way or another. Walz says he will propose a gun control package in the coming days. It will include a ban on the heavy weaponry frequently used in mass shootings and often referred to as assault weapons. The Republican caucus released a school safety agenda last week that didn't include any proposals on gun control. They're calling for increased funding for school safety at private schools, boosting funding for more mental health treatment beds, and increasing penalties for repeat firearm offenders. Their agenda also includes reversing a conversion therapy ban for minors, which would allow therapists to try to change a person's sexual orientation or gender. The West Fraser Wood Engineering Plant west of Bemidji is one of three companies to receive a portion of $4.2 million in business expansion grants from the state. The company plans to renovate an existing building and improve the operating site in the small community of Solway. The operation there produces engineered wood products such as OSB or particle board that are used widely in construction and other industries. The project will receive more than $1 million in financing from the state's Job Creation Fund, with the company expected to invest $137 million. The project is expected to retain 132 jobs, according to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is predicting great fall color this year as they roll out their annual Fall Color Finder. Fall color typically peaks from late September through mid-October, starting in the northwest portion of the state and working toward the southeast corner. Brian Schwingel is a Forest Health Program consultant with the DNR. He says the right mix of temperatures and moisture that occurred this year means there's a good likelihood of vibrant colors. A drier May means less leaf disease that can lead to defoliation, and the overall lack of drought this summer means less stress on the trees. The cooler September thus far also promotes prettier fall colors and will likely lead to earlier color.
When you get those cool temperatures that don't quite get down to freezing, you get more of those red pigments produced in the leaves.
Peak color usually lasts about 1 week once it arrives, but can vary widely depending on location and weather. In fact, Schwingel had this to say about the variation.
I honestly think that predicting fall colors is more complicated than rocket science. I'm not kidding. There are so many variables that have been studied and continue to be studied.
Both Itasca and Lake Bemidji State Parks are among those offering fall color themed events. Learn about how animals survive the changing seasons this Saturday at Lake Bemidji on a half-mile walk along the Bogwalk Trail.
And the Lookin' at Leaves hike around the Dr. Roberts Trail in Itasca is 2 miles and takes place 10:30 to noon on September 20th. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 33 million people have had their citizenship status checked by a tool developed by the Trump administration to verify voter rolls. While some Republican-led states are eagerly running their entire voter list through the tool, many others are not. That's in part due to data security and privacy concerns. NPR's Jude Joffe Block and Miles Parks were the first to report on the tool's development this summer. They join me now. Hi there.
Hey there.
Hey.
Jude, I'll start with you. What is the citizenship check tool and how's it work?
Yeah, it's called SAVE, and it's long existed as an immigration data system within the Department of Homeland Security. And the Trump administration made it a priority to revamp SAVE. And one of the goals was to make it easier for states to verify that only U.S. citizens are on their voter rolls. And this summer, they made a series of changes that make it far more accessible to states. So suddenly the number of voters that states are putting through it has jumped. And one big change is that SAVE now links to Social Security data. So it's now supposed to verify citizenship of most Americans and show a federal record say they're deceased. Several election officials we spoke with from both parties say if it works, this upgraded version of SAVE could be a helpful tool to get dead people off the rolls faster and for verifying citizenship without inconveniencing voters.
Miles, over to you. What states have used this so far?
So we know Texas, Missouri, and Ohio have started using it, but we've gotten the most information so far from Louisiana. That state announced last week that they ran almost all of their voters, their 2.9 million voters, through SAVE. And they found only a tiny number of people, 79, who they suspect are non-citizens and have voted in an election sometime between now and the 1980s. That's less than 0.003% of their voter rolls.
And they found a slightly larger number of suspected non-citizens who never voted. But in other states, this sort of effort to identify non-citizens has in the past mistakenly ensnared U.S. citizens. So in Louisiana, Secretary of State Nancy Landry says her office reviewed each case and are asking them to prove their citizenship. Otherwise, they're being removed from the voter rolls. And Landry's referring them to law enforcement for prosecution. President Trump has called for such cases to be a priority.
But many states are not using the system. Did they tell you why?
Yeah, we heard from both Democratic and Republican-controlled states that aren't using it. And there are two big concerns, accuracy and security. On the accuracy front, the federal government says they've greatly improved it, but they haven't made any data public about the results SAVE spits out. The last thing a voting official wants to do is mark a person as either a non-citizen or dead if a person is neither of those things. So they need to be convinced that the data is reliable, right? On security, states are very wary also of handing over personal information on their voters, even to the federal government. Some states actually have laws in place that might conflict with using the tool. Mississippi Secretary of State Michael Watson, a Republican, told me SAVE sounded like a great tool, but that he still has some questions.
We just want to make sure, where's that data going? And at the end of the day, is it stored? What are they going to do with it? Who has access? Is it shared? Is it, you name it?
To that point, both of you have reported that the Department of Justice has been asking for similar election data from states as well. How are these efforts related?
That is a question that voting officials have, too. At a meeting with secretaries of state earlier this summer, an official asked DHS the same thing, and they were told that the two agencies, DOJ and DHS, are separate entities. But DHS retention policies mean that any data that's run through SAVE stays with the federal government for 10 years. Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, who's a Democrat, said that policy essentially means SAVE could create a national database of voters, which would raise serious privacy and security concerns.
Because it's never a question of if a large database is going to be hacked, but when and to what consequence. If Mayor Garland were asking for this, or President Biden, I have to think that the red states would be calling for their heads.
Last thing, what's the federal government saying publicly about this tool?
Well, not much, even to Congress. Three Democratic senators reached out to DHS with a number of questions about everything we've talked about here, and they still haven't heard back. But we reported earlier this summer that the agency has briefed an organization that denies the 2020 election results.
So you can kind of see why some voting officials are skeptical about it. You know, the goals sound reasonable, but Trump has made baseless claims about non-citizens voting in American elections for years, and there's concern about all the different ways that this tool and the data that goes along with it could be potentially co-opted for that purpose.
NPR's Miles Parks and Jude Joffe Block, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Since June, a wave of artists has removed their music from Spotify. Now, Spotify is the largest streaming service in the world, but musicians are leaving the platform in protest of the CEO's investments, as NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports.
That's King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. If you wanted to listen to their music today on Spotify, you can't. That's because they're one of several bands, including Deerhoof, Shushu, and Hotline TNT, that have left Spotify in objection to CEO Daniel Ek's ties to a German defense company. In June, Ek's venture capital firm invested more than $700 million into Helsing. The startup focuses on artificial intelligence for military applications. And many artists aren't happy about this, including Jamie Stewart of the rock band Shushu.
That wasn't something that we could just say, okay, whatever, there's nothing we can do about this. There was something that we could do about that.
So Shushu removed their discography. Spotify and Helsing declined to comment on artists leaving the streaming service. But Stewart says their concerns span far beyond how the CEO spends his earnings.
The sound quality is horrible. The disposableness of music has become almost culturally endemic. And then obviously the financial aspect of it is just like a joke almost.
Spotify uses a stream share model, meaning that if an artist's catalog accounts for 1% of streams on the platform, the artist earns 1% of total royalties. Many artists are frustrated with this payout system, and they're looking for alternatives. The indie rock band Hotline TNT recently hosted a 24-hour live stream to promote sales of their album, Raspberry Moon. Singer and guitarist Will Anderson sold over 300 copies on Bandcamp alone. He says that's more revenue in a single day than the band makes from months worth of streams.
You know, when someone buys one of our records at a show, no one's going to take the music off their shelf overnight like we just did with Spotify.
For some artists, that push to an ownership model works. In February, the folk pop singer Caroline Rose released the album Year of the Slug. The album's not available on any streaming platforms. Fans can buy it on Bandcamp or directly from Rose at a show. She says it's been her most profitable release to date, and it's allowed her to reconnect with fans.
It's been extremely fulfilling. I want a career of quality rather than simply any and everything quantifiable.
Caroline Rose says she wants to take the focus away from the numbers and put it back into the music. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News. Go with cheese, go out dancing, watch the clouds. It's okay to be yourself. Draw a portrait, hail a cab, fall asleep in her lap. To feel joy, to feel pain, to feel pleasure, to feel shame. Feel it by just be okay. Ever-
everything in its right place, everything.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Rising housing costs are pushing a growing number of older Americans into homelessness. Last year, one in five people who were homeless were over the age of 55. Some organizations are using a creative approach to help older people get stable housing and the medical care they need. Lynn Arditti of the Publix Radio in Rhode Island explains.
At age 82, Roberta Rabinowitz had no place to go. A widow, she had lost both her daughters to cancer. She'd lived with one of them and then the other, nursing them until their deaths. Then she moved in with her brother in Florida and helped care for him until he died.
Found myself very depressed and what's going to happen to me? Where am I going to go? I don't know what I'm going to do.
So last fall, she moved again, this time into her grandson's apartment in Burrville, a small community in northern Rhode Island. She was recovering from lung cancer, sleeping on the couch. To take a shower, she had to climb a steep staircase, but she had nowhere else to live. Her only income was Social Security, and rents for a safer place to live were out of reach. Rabinowitz once lived a middle-class life in the suburbs of Boston. But after her husband died, she was left with little savings. Like many women widowed in their 50s after children are grown, but long before Social Security kicks in, her finances had deteriorated along with her health.
It's a national scandal, really, that the richest country in the world would have destitute, elderly, and disabled people.
Dennis Culhane researches homelessness at the University of Pennsylvania. For some seniors, a single incident can tip them into homelessness. The death of a spouse, a job loss, a rent increase, an injury or illness. Sandy Markwood is CEO of the National Association U.S. Aging.
No one imagines anybody living on the street at 75 and 80, but they are.
For Rabinowitz, signing up for a plan with an organization called PACE changed her life. PACE stands for Programs of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. PACE health plans operate in 33 states. They enroll people 55 and older who are sick enough for nursing home care and then provide everything their patients need to stay out of nursing homes. PACE pools clients' Medicare and Medicaid money and uses it to pay for medical care, meals, housing, and other regular expenses. Rising housing costs can be a problem for PACE. Robert Greenwood of the National PACE Association says programs around the country have to be creative.
PACE programs are partnering with senior housing providers, leasing apartments from housing providers, and then developing housing themselves when it's appropriate.
In Rhode Island, PACE helped Rabinowitz move off her grandson's couch and into her own apartment in an assisted living facility, one of four that PACE reserves for its clients. A few months later, she invited me in for a visit.
Hi, Roberta.
Oh, honey, how are you?
She ushers me into her studio apartment.
This is my penthouse.
She's decorated it in purple, her favorite color. Medicaid rules allow her to keep $120 a month from her Social Security check for personal items.
I wake up every morning and think, oh, I have to go to breakfast. Isn't that wonderful?
She's happy to have a home of her own. For NPR News, I'm Lynn Arditti in Providence, Rhode Island.
And the story was co-reported with Felice Fryer as part of our partnership with KFF Health News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You are listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, we will hear about a new wave of artist-led protests against Spotify. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We will also hear the set list shortly after 6 o'clock. And coming up at 7, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering of community members with events focused on equity, connection, and community resilience. Taking place at the Gitche Zibe Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. More info at sewingroom.org. That is spelled S-O-W-I-N-G. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Weather for tonight, patchy fog late, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52. Widespread fog early tomorrow morning, then becoming mostly sunny, high 71 to 74. Chance of rain in the evening and overnight lows near 60. Looking ahead to Friday, slight chance of showers in the morning, then partly sunny, temperatures in the upper 70s. We've received support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet this Sunday, September 14th, at the Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. And the biathlon trails at Mount Itasca near Coleraine are closed until September 22nd due to logging on the east side of the hill.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For decades, Israeli settlers lived in the Gaza Strip, protected by soldiers. 20 years ago, Israel evacuated them. And today, Israelis wonder if that paved the way for the October 7th Hamas attack and if Israel should resettle Gaza, as Itai Stern reports from Tel Aviv.
These were the scenes Israeli TV broadcast 20 years ago. Israeli settlers screaming at soldiers evacuating them from their homes in Gaza. I was there too, as a young journalist with an Israeli newspaper. I was embedded with Israeli troops carrying out the disengagement. That was the initiative of the Israeli Prime Minister at that time, Ariel Sharon, removing some 8,000 settlers from Gaza. The scenes were chaotic. Israeli settler families were weeping. Soldiers were carrying children out of their homes, and young kids were running to the beach to get away from them. Esther Kaufman-Yachi was a proud 13-year-old Jewish settler in Gaza at that time.
It was an amazing place to grow up. Playgrounds, green spaces, a close-knit community, but always under fire. We rode in armored cars, but we knew why we were there, to protect Israel's borders.
She says the evacuation was an expulsion.
I was in seventh grade. I stood in a circle of soldiers trying to explain to them what a mistake they were making. Eventually, they carried us out. The trauma stays with you all the time.
In 2005, Israel uprooted the settlements and soldiers from Gaza after years of Palestinian attacks. Most of the attacks were carried out by Hamas. Just 2 years later, Hamas fought a battle for power with its Palestinian rifle and took control of Gaza by force. In response, Israel imposed a blockade on Gaza that continues to this day. Kaufman Yarchi says, we gave up the territory and it became a hornet's nest. If Jews had stayed in Gaza, I believe October 7th would not have happened. Dov Weissglass was Prime Minister Sharon's closest aide. He helped plan the disengagement.
In the long term, the Israeli national interest is not to be in Gaza. Every single casualty in Gaza, whether it's a soldier or a settler, it's a waste.
Weissglass says, at that time, Israeli officials were afraid Hamas might one day take over Gaza. But he argues keeping settlers in Gaza would have been worse.
Without the disengagement in Gaza, I tell you what will happen. Those 7,000 good Israelis who lived in the heart of Gaza, they would face October 7th, not in 2023, but in 2008.
A poll by an Israeli newspaper this summer found around half of Israelis support reestablishing settlements in Gaza. Weissglass says that will not happen.
It's not serious. I don't think that we are now have the manpower, the means, the energy the resources now to allocate so many soldiers.
While Israel argued that removing settlers from Gaza saved lives, it helped Hamas promote itself among Palestinians as the group that defeated Israel. Yohanan Tzoref is an Israeli expert of Palestinian affairs.
They began to talk about the resistance as the main power in the Palestinian arena, because the resistance is the power who pushed out Israel from Gaza.
After Israel left Gaza and Hamas took control there, Hamas spent years firing rockets at Israel and fought several wars with Israel. Tzoref says Israel also has responsibility for years of violence in Gaza.
Since 2009, there is governments in Israel that disagree to make any kind of compromises, and they used to say it approximately every day, that there is no way to make peace.
Throughout the Gaza war, some Israeli leaders have called for Gaza to be resettled by Jews. Netanyahu says it's not realistic, but many former Gaza settlers, like Esther Kalfan-Yachi, have hoped they could return to what they call home.
My children know that one day we'll go back. I still keep a bottle of sand from there. The idea is to scatter it when we return home.
Israelis are divided on whether that is the right move after the Gaza war, or whether it's a dangerous fantasy. For NPR News, I'm Itai Stern in Tel Aviv.
Late summer is blackberry season in the Pacific Northwest. NPR's Brian Mann found a berry patch while out trail running on an island in Oregon's Columbia River. He sent us this audio postcard.
It's a hot September afternoon as I set off running past farm fields into the woods on Savi Island.
This is a perfect trail running trail. Soft forest floor.
The path is flat and gentle, with views of the sweeping Columbia River through the trees. After a day of work, I love finding places like this where I can turn off my brain for a while and just move and breathe. Today, I find an unexpected delight, blackberry thicket, so dense I have to dodge the thorns as I run.
The fruit is ripe. I'm just picking and eating as I go. Oh, yeah. Just perfect timing. There we go.
Again and again, the berries tempt me to slow down and snack, but I finally run on, my fingers stained purple. I can smell the river and the leaf dust of the trail kicked up by my running shoes. Afternoon sun sweeps through the high forest. This island has deep history. It was busy with Multnomah native villages through the 18th century, communities that were later swept away by European diseases. The American explorers, Lewis and Clark, also camped nearby on their expedition in 1805 and 1806.
I've come out of a tunnel of trees into a beautiful open green meadow. The wind is blowing through the grass. Wildflowers on every side, tansy and Queen Anne's lace, bright late summer.
I love running in this season, when the heat has mellowed, but it's not quite autumn. Kids are back in school, so the crowds in wild places like this have faded away. This trail on Savi Island takes me to an old lighthouse and a long ribbon of beach. A barge rumbles past out on the river. Otherwise, it's private and still, so I strip off my running shoes and my t-shirt and dive in.
I am swimming in the Columbia River at this wild sand beach all to myself. And the cold water feels so good on my body after that run. Yeah, just wild, and the wind is kind of blowing over the water. Islands stretching off in every direction. Brian Mann, NPR News, in the Columbia River in St. Helens, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments,
Learn more at avalara.com/propertytax. From Mathnasium, whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build skills and confidence through personalized math instruction to help students achieve their potential this school year. Learn more at mathnasium.com. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. This is NPR.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. And you can find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Jennifer Barr, coming up next, As It Happens, and 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone.